Why would I?
I don't know. Because you want to?
Loretta made it sound so simple. But Blake would laugh. A waste of time and money, he'd tell her. Besides, she'd never even finished high school.
It's too late for all that, she finally said.
Well, what's it you like to study?
I used to like math.
Now Loretta laughed.
Well, you must be some big brain, she said. Don't nobody just like math for fun.
But she loved the simplicity of math, a number growing or shrinking, depending on which function you performed. No surprises, just one logical step leading to another. Loretta leaned forward, watching the girls play. She didn't seem at all like the uppity wife everyone gossiped about, the one who wanted to force her way into the Brentwood Academy. She didn't even seem like she wanted to live in Los Angeles at all. After college, she'd planned to return to Missouri, maybe earn her master's. Then she'd fallen for Reg and gotten swept up in his dreams.
So why did you move here? Stella asked. The estates, I mean.
Loretta raised an eyebrow.
Why did you?
Well, the schools. It's a nice neighborhood, don't you think? Clean, safe.
She gave the answers she ought to, although she wasn't so sure. She'd moved to Los Angeles for Blake's job, and sometimes she felt like she'd had no say in the matter. Other times, she remembered how thrilling the possibility of Los Angeles had seemed, all those miles between there and her old life. Foolish to pretend that she hadn't chosen this city. She wasn't some little tugboat drifting along with the tide. She had created herself. Since the morning she'd walked out of the Maison Blanche building a white girl, she had decided everything.
Then don't you think I'd want those same things too?
Loretta said.
Yes, but don't you... I mean, it's got to be easier, isn't it, if you...
Stuck to my own kind.
Loretta lit another cigarette, her face shining like bronze.
Why, yes, Stella said. I just don't know why anyone would want to do it. I mean, there are plenty of fine colored neighborhoods, and folks can be so hateful.
They're gonna hate me anyway, Loretta said.
Might as well hate me in my big house with all of my nice things.
She smiled, taking another drag of her cigarette, and that sly smile reminded Stella of Desiree. She felt like a girl again, sneaking a smoke on the porch while their mother slept. She reached for Loretta's cigarette, leaning into the glow. You had the Johansons, of course, on Magnolia Way. Dill worked downtown in finance. Kath served as secretary of the Brentwood Academy PTA. Even though she hardly took minutes at all during the meetings, you couldn't guess how many times Stella had glanced at her notepad and found it blank. Then the Whites, over on Juniper. Percy worked in accounting at one of the studios. She couldn't remember which, Blake would know. He was also association president, but he'd only run because his wife kept pushing him to be more ambitious. Lynn was from Oklahoma, an oil family, and God only knew how she'd found herself saddled with Percy White. You'd understand if you took a look at him, but let's just say he wasn't what she had in mind when she dreamt of marrying a man who worked in Hollywood. Then the Hawthorns on Maple. Bob had about the whitest teeth she'd ever seen in her life.
I think I've seen him, Loretta said.
Big ones, too? Kind of like Mr. Ed.
Stella laughed, nearly dropping the ball of blue yarn. Across the leather couch, Loretta smirked the way she always did when she knew she'd said something funny, which was often, now that they were on their second glass of wine.
You'll see them all soon, Stella said. They're all nice enough people.
To you, Loretta said. You know you're the only one who's darkened my door.
Stella did know. But she tried not to dwell on that fact. She watched the yarn slip out in front of her.
Loretta's crochet hook winding through the air. When she called Loretta earlier and asked if the girls might want to play again, she figured they would meet up at the park. She did not expect Loretta to invite her over, or for herself to accept. Now the girls were playing in the Walker's backyard. You could hear their yelps through the screen door, and she was tipsy from the wine, listening to Loretta talk about witnessing Reg's acting career finally take off. How, even though he found Frisk stultifying, he was grateful to play a cop for once, not another street hood snatching some lady's purse in the opening credits. Loretta went to set with him from time to time, but found the whole business so dreadfully boring, she usually ended up in a corner somewhere, crocheting. It amazed Stella how deeply unimpressed Loretta seemed by every fantastic aspect of her life. Whenever Loretta asked her a question, Stella grew embarrassed, aware of how little she had to offer.
"I told you," she said. "I'm really not that interesting."
"Oh, I don't believe that for a second," Loretta said. "I bet there's all sorts of fascinating things swirling around inside that head of yours."
"I assure you, there isn't," she said. "I'm as plain as they come."
She'd done one interesting thing in her whole life, but she would spend the rest of her days hiding it. When Loretta asked about her childhood, she always hedged. She couldn't share any memory of her youth without also conjuring Desiree. All of her memories were cleaved in half, her sister excised right out of them, and how lonely they seemed now. Stella swimming by herself at the river, wandering through sugarcane fields, running breathlessly from a goose chasing her down the road. A lonely past, a lonely present. Until now. Somehow, Loretta Walker had become the only person she could talk to. All summer, she waited for Loretta's phone calls. She might be watching her daughter paint watercolors in the backyard when the kitchen phone rang, and just like that, she'd pack up the paint set, glancing carefully down the street before ushering Kennedy across. Or she might be on her way to the public library for story time when Loretta phoned. And suddenly, the overdue books were no longer as important as venturing across the cul-de-sac. When they returned home, she told her daughter not to mention the playdate to Blake.
"Why?"
Kennedy asked. Stella knelt in front of her, untying her shoes.
"Because," she said. "Daddy likes us to be at home. But if you don't say anything, we can keep going across the street. You'd like that, wouldn't you?"
Her daughter put her hands on her shoulders, as if she were giving her a stern talking to, but she was only balancing herself as she stepped out of her tennis shoes.
"Okay,"
she said so simply it stung. Like anything, lying to her daughter became easier over time. She was raising Kennedy to lie too, although the girl would never know it. She was white. She would never think of herself as anything else. If she ever learned the truth, she would hate her mother for deceiving her. The thought flashed through her head each time Loretta called. But each time, she steeled her nerve, took her daughter by the hand, and stepped across the street. On Wednesday afternoons, the tan Buick pulled into the Walker's driveway just past lunchtime, and Kath Johansson called Stella to gossip.
"I knew there wouldn't be just one," she said.
She was convinced the colored women were there to scout out the neighborhood to plan their own eventual arrival. Stella clamped the phone against her cheek, peering through the kitchen blinds as Loretta's girlfriends climbed out. The tall one was Belinda Cooper. Her husband composed movie scores for Warner Brothers. Mary Butler in the cat-eyed glasses was married to a pediatrician. She was sorority sisters with Eunice Woods, whose husband had just sold a screenplay to MGM. Stella knew basic things about the ladies that Loretta had told her, but she'd never expected to meet any of the women until one Wednesday when Loretta called to tell her that Mary was sick. Would she like to be their fourth hand?
"I'm not much of a bit-whist player," Stella said.
She was terrible at cards, at any game that relied on chance.
Honey, that's all right, Loretta said. Sometimes we don't even take out the cards.
Playing bidwhist, she learned, was mostly a guise for what the women really wanted to do, which was drink wine and gossip. Belinda Cooper, halfway through her second glass of Riesling, kept going on about a movie actor having a sloppy affair with one of the secretaries at Warner, a pretty young thing, but bold as you know what, taking messages from his wife, then slipping down to his trailer to deliver much more than a missed call.
These girls are getting bolder today, Loretta said.
She took another drag of her cigarette, not even touching her cards.
You know, me and Reg went out to Carl's the other day and ran into Mary Ann.
How was she?
Pregnant, again.
Lord.
And you know what she had to say. Uni, it's your hand, baby.
Mary Ann never liked me,
Una said.
You remember that time at Thelma's wedding?
All of their conversations went like this, around and around in loops that Stella couldn't follow. She wasn't meant to understand their shorthand or glean complicated backstories from the cast of characters they introduced. To be there at all, really. But she was happy to sit quietly, fiddling with her cards, listening. If Belinda and Eunice had a problem with her being there, they didn't say. But they spoke around her, never directly to her, as if to tell Loretta, this is your responsibility. Still, the afternoon passed, pleasantly enough, until the girls rushed in for snacks. It always struck Stella how natural Loretta seemed around Cindy. The girl clambered to her side, rubbing against her like a cat, and Loretta, without even breaking the conversation, reached for her. She seemed to know what Cindy wanted before she even asked for it. When the girls ran back upstairs, Eunice took a drag of her cigarette and said,
I still don't know why you're so set on doing it.
Doing what? Loretta said.
You know what? I know this is your new life now.
Oh, please.
But your girl's gonna be miserable, and we all know it. It's not worth it just to make a point.
It's not about making a point, Loretta said. The school's right down the street. And Cindy's just as smart as all those other kids.
We know, honey, Belinda said. It's not about being right. You can be right till the cows come home. But this is your one child, and this is her one life.
You think I don't know that, Loretta said. Her eyes flashed, and then, remembering herself, she laughed a little, stubbing out her cigarette.
Thank God all of us don't think like you two.
Let's ask your new friend, Eunice said. What do you make of all of this, Mrs. Sanders?
Stella stared down at the card table, her neck already hot.
Oh, I don't know, she said. Surely you have some opinion.
Eunice was giving Stella a smile that reminded her of a hunting dog with a rabbit in his teeth. The more you twitched away, the tighter those jaws fastened around you.
I wouldn't do it, she finally said. Those other parents will make her life hell. They'll want to make an example out of her. You don't know how they talk when you're not around. And I bet you jump right to her defense, too,
Eunice said. That's enough, Loretta said softly. But she didn't have to. By then, the mood had soured. Belinda and Eunice left before the game even finished. Stella washed the wine glasses while the girls cleaned up their toys upstairs. It was getting late, nearly 4. Blake would almost be home. Beside her, Loretta silently dried the glasses with a plaid dish towel.
I'm sorry, Stella said.
For what, exactly, she didn't know. Sorry for coming over? For ruining the card game, for being exactly who Eunice Woods accused her of being. She didn't defend Loretta, not even to silly Kath Johansson. She conscripted her own daughter to lie, afraid her husband would find out she socialized with the woman. Loretta gave her a strange smile.
You think I want your guilt? She said.
Your guilt can't do nothing for me, honey.
You want to go feel good about feeling bad, you can go on and do it right across the street.
Stella set the wet glass on the countertop, dried her hands on the towel. So this is what Loretta really thought about her. A white woman swarming around to assuage her guilt. And wasn't it true? She did feel guilty, but if anything, spending time with Loretta only made her feel even worse. Her real life seemed even more fake by comparison. And yet, she didn't want to stay away, not even now. Not when Loretta was angry at her. Loretta reached for the wet glass and knocked it off the counter, the glass shattering at their feet. She stared up at the ceiling, suddenly exhausted. She was too young to look this tired, but she must be, fighting all the time. Stella never fought. She always gave in. She was a coward that way. Loretta bent to pick up the glass, but not thinking, Stella jutted her arm out and said,
"Don't, baby, you cut yourself."
Then she was kneeling on the tile, cleaning up the mess she'd made. First Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis, then Bobby Kennedy in downtown Los Angeles. Soon it felt like you couldn't open a paper without seeing the bleeding body of an important man. Stella started switching off the news when her daughter came bounding into the kitchen for breakfast. Loretta said that, a couple months ago, Cindy asked her what assassination meant. She told her the truth, of course, that an assassination is when someone kills you to make a point. Which was correct enough, Stella supposed, but only if you were an important man. Important men became martyrs, unimportant ones, victims. The important men were given televised funerals, public days of mourning. Their deaths inspired the creation of art and the destruction of cities. But unimportant men were killed to make the point that they were unimportant, that they were not even men, and the world continued on. Sometimes she still had dreams that someone was breaking into her house. More than once, she'd prodded Blake out of bed to check.
"I told you it's a safe neighborhood," he grumbled, climbing back under the covers.
But hadn't she felt safe once, years ago, hidden in a little white house surrounded by trees? Now she slept with the baseball bat behind the headboard.
"What are you gonna do with that, slugger?"
Blake said, squeezing her tiny bicep. But when he traveled for business, she could never fall asleep without touching the worn handle, just to remind herself that it was there.
"You never talk about your family," Loretta said.
In her backyard, she stretched out on a lawn chair, her face half hidden behind sunglasses. She wore a purple bathing suit, her legs still speckled with water from the pool. Stella craned her neck, watching the girls splash around. In 2 weeks, school was starting again, Kennedy back at the Brentwood Academy, Cindy off to St. Francis in Santa Monica. A good school, only half an hour away, Loretta said, and Stella felt relieved. She wanted to tell Loretta that it was for the best. There was nothing wrong with putting your head down and trying to survive. But she would only have made Loretta feel even more like she'd given in. Now Loretta was complaining about her in-laws flying in from Chicago. They planned to stay 10 whole days, and Reg, of course, said yes, because he could never tell them no, and because, of course, she would have to do most of the entertaining while he was off to set.
"What about you?" Loretta said. "Does your husband get along with your parents?"
The pointed question caught Stella off guard. She was distracted, already wondering what she would do with the 10 days when she wouldn't see Loretta at all.
"My folks are long gone," she said. "They're..."
She trailed off, unable to finish. Loretta's face fell.
"Oh, honey, I'm sorry," she said. "Look at me bringing up bad memories."
"It's all right," Stella said. "It happened so long ago."
"You were young, were you?"
"Young enough," she said. "It was an accident. Nobody's fault. Bad things happen. They just do."
What about brothers or sisters? Loretta said.
No brothers.
Stella paused, then said,
I had a twin sister. You remind me of her a little.
She hadn't planned to say this, and as soon as she did, she regretted it. But Loretta only laughed. How so? She said.
Oh, I don't know. Little ways. She was funny. Bold. Nothing like me, really.
She felt herself tearing up, hurried to dab her eyes.
I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm going on like this.
Don't be sorry, Loretta said. You lost your whole family. If anything's worth boo-hooing about, it's that. And a sister, too? Have mercy.
I still think about her, Stella said. I didn't know I would still think about her like this.
Of course you do, Loretta said. Losing a twin must be like losing half of yourself.
Sometimes she imagined picking up the phone and calling Desiree just to hear her voice. But she didn't know how to reach her. And besides, what would she even say? Too many years had passed. What good would looking back do? She was tired of justifying a choice she'd already made. She didn't want to be pulled back into a life that was no longer hers.
Twins, Loretta said, as if the word itself contained magic. You know what my mama used to say? She could always tell if a woman will have twins right from her palm. Now Stella laughed.
What?
Oh, yeah. You never had your palm read? Look, I'll show you. Loretta reached suddenly for Stella's hand. See this line right here? That's your child line. If it forks out, it means you'll have twins. But you got just the one. And this here, this is your love line. See how it goes deep and straight? That means you'll be married a long time. And this one's your lifeline. Look how it splits.
And what's that mean?
It means your life's been interrupted.
Loretta smiled, and again Stella wondered if she knew. Maybe the whole time, Loretta had just been playing along. The thought was humiliating, but strangely liberating. Maybe Stella could tell her the whole story now, and maybe Loretta would understand that she hadn't meant to betray anyone, but she'd just needed to be new. It was her life. Why couldn't she decide if she wanted a new one? But Loretta laughed. She was only joking. You couldn't read a person's life off her hand, let alone a life as complicated as Stella's. Still, she liked sitting here, Loretta tracing a fingernail along her palm.
Okay, Stella said. What else does it say?
Chapter 9. In New Orleans, Stella split in two. She didn't notice it at first because she'd been two people her whole life. She was herself and she was Desiree. The twins, beautiful and rare, were never called the girls, only the twins, as if it were a formal title. She'd always thought of herself as part of this pair, but in New Orleans, she splintered into a new woman altogether after she got fired from Dixie Laundry. She'd been daydreaming during her shift, thinking, again, about the morning she'd visited the museum as a white girl. Being white wasn't the most exciting part. Being anyone else was the thrill. To transform into a different person in plain sight, nobody around her even able to tell. She'd never felt so free. But she was so distracted by her own remembering, she almost caught her hand in the mangle. The near accident was dangerous enough for May to fire her. Any workplace injury would be bad, but an accident involving a girl illegally hired was too much of a risk.
You lucky you just fired, May told her.
Lucky because she'd only lost a job, not a hand, or lucky because she'd only been let go,
Desiree offered a stern warning. Either way, she needed a new job. For weeks, she reported to the temp agency and spent all afternoon in crowded waiting rooms, leaving with the promise that she could try again in the morning. She dreaded facing Desiree each evening she returned home to find their money jar dwindling. Then, the Sunday before rent was due, she spotted a job listing in the paper. Maison Blanche was looking for young ladies with fine handwriting and proficient typing skills to fill an opening in the marketing department, no office experience necessary. She'd always gotten good marks for her typing, but a department store would never hire a colored girl to do more than put away shoes or spray perfume at the counters. Still, Desiree told her she had to apply.
"This'll pay way more than Dixie Laundry," she said. "You have to go down there and see."
She almost said no, told Desiree forget it. So what if she could type? Why subject herself to the humiliation of some prim white secretary telling her that colored girls need not apply? Still, she woke up the next morning, put on her nice dress, and rode the streetcar to Canal Street. It was her fault that they were running out of money in the first place. She had to at least try. The elevator carried her to the sixth floor, where she stepped into a waiting room filled with white girls. She halted in the doorway, wondering if she should just turn back. But the blonde secretary waved her over.
"I need your typing sample, dear," she said.
Stella could have left. Instead, she carefully filled out the application and typed up the sample paragraph. Her hands trembled as she pressed the keys. She was terrified of being discovered, but almost more afraid that she wouldn't be. And then what? This wasn't the same as sneaking into the art museum. If she was hired, she would have to be white every day. And if she couldn't sit in this waiting room without her hands shaking, how could she ever manage that? When the secretary announced that the position was filled, she felt relieved. She'd applied. At least she could tell Desiree that she'd done her best. She quickly gathered her coat and her pocketbook, heading toward the elevator, when the secretary asked if Miss Veens could start tomorrow. At Maison Blanche, Stella addressed envelopes for Mr. Sanders. He was the youngest associate in the marketing department and movie star handsome, so all the other girls in the building envied her. Carol Warren, a busty blonde from Lafayette, told Stella she didn't know how lucky she was. Carol worked for Mr. Reed, who was nice enough, she supposed, even though she couldn't stop staring at the gray hairs sprouting out his ears when he dictated messages. But what it must be like to work for Mr. Sanders. Carol chewed her salad eagerly, waiting for Stella to share some delicious detail about him, but she didn't know what to say. She hardly spoke to the man at all, except in the mornings when he dropped his coat and hat on her desk, and when he returned from lunch and she passed on his messages. "Thanks, dear," he always said, reading the scraps of paper as he started back into his office. She didn't think he even knew her name.
"A real dish, isn't he?"
Carol whispered once after she'd caught Stella staring. She flushed, shaking her head quickly. The last thing she needed was to get caught up in the office gossip. She kept to herself, arrived on time, left when she was supposed to. She ate lunch at her desk and spoke as little as possible, certain that she'd say the wrong thing and make somebody wonder about her. She certainly tried not to speak around Mr. Sanders, only offering a soft hello when he greeted her. One morning, he paused in front of her desk, his briefcase swinging at his side.
"You don't talk much," he said.
It wasn't a question, but she still felt compelled to answer.
"I'm sorry, sir," she said. "I've always been quiet."
"I'll say."
He started toward his office, then suddenly turned.
"Let me take you out to lunch today. I like to get to know the girls who work for me."
Then he patted the desk as if she'd said yes to show that it had been decided. All morning, she was so rattled, she kept misaddressing her envelopes. By lunchtime, she hoped that Mr. Sanders would forget about his offer, but he emerged from his office and beckoned her to follow him, so off they went. In Antoine's, Blake ordered oysters, and when she stared silently at the menu, an alligator soup for both of them.
You're not from around here, are you?
He asked. She shook her head.
No, sir, she said. I was born... Well, it's a little town north of here.
Nothing wrong with little towns. I like little towns.
He smiled at her, lifting the spoon to his mouth, and she tried to smile back. Later that evening, when Desiree demanded details from her, Stella wouldn't remember the emerald green wallpaper, the framed photographs of famous New Orleanians, the taste of the soup. Nothing but that smile Mr. Sanders had given her. No white man had ever smiled at her so kindly.
Here's what we'll do, he said. Anything you want to know about the city, anything at all, you ask me. Don't feel silly about it. I know how strange a new city can be.
She paused.
How do you eat those?
She asked, pointing to the oysters. He laughed.
You've never had oysters? I thought all you Louisiana people loved them.
We never had much money. I always wondered.
I didn't mean to poke fun, he said. I'll show you. It's very simple.
He reached for the fork, glancing up at her.
You belong here, Stella. Don't ever think you don't.
At work, Stella became Miss Veens, or as Desiree called her, White Stella. Desiree always giggled after, as if she found the very idea preposterous, which irritated Stella. She wanted Desiree to see how convincingly she played her role, but she was living a performance where there could be no audience. Only a person who knew her real identity would appreciate her acting, and nobody at work could ever know. At the same time, Desiree could never meet Miss Veens. Stella could only be her when Desiree was not around. In the morning, during her ride to Maison Blanche, she closed her eyes and slowly became her. She imagined another life, another past. No footsteps thundering up the porch steps. No ruddy white man grabbing her father. No Mr. DuPont pressing against her in the pantry. No Mama. No Desiree. She let her mind go blank, her whole life vanishing, until she became new and clean as a baby. Soon she no longer felt nervous as the elevator glided skyward and she stepped into the office. You belong here, Blake had told her. Soon she thought of him as Blake, not Mr. Sanders, and she began to notice how he lingered at her desk now when he said good morning, how he invited her to lunch more often, how he began walking her to the streetcar after work.
It's not safe out here, he said once, pausing at the crosswalk. A pretty girl like you walking alone.
When she was with Blake, no one bothered her. The leering white men who'd tried to flirt with her at her stop now fell suddenly silent. The colored men sitting in the back didn't even look in her direction. At Maison Blanche, she once overheard another associate refer to her as Blake's girl, and she felt as if that distinction covered her even beyond the office building, as if just by venturing into the world as Blake's girl, she had been changed somehow. Soon she began to look forward to stepping through the glass doors, ambling slowly down the sidewalk with Blake. Soon she noticed how when he blinked, his eyelashes were dark and full, like a baby doll. How on days when he had a big presentation, he wore bulldog cufflinks, which he admitted, almost bashfully, were a gift from his ex-fiancée. The relationship had failed, but he still considered them lucky.
You're observant, Stella, he said. I don't think anybody's ever asked me about these before.
She noticed everything about him, but she didn't tell this to anyone, especially not Desiree. This life wasn't real. If Blake knew who she truly was, he would send her out of the office before she could even pack her things. But what had changed about her? Nothing, really. She hadn't adopted a disguise or even a new name. She'd walked in a colored girl and left a white one. She had become white only because everyone thought she was. Each evening, she went through the process in reverse. Miss Veens climbed onto the streetcar where she became, again, Stella. At home, Stella never liked to talk about work, even when Desiree asked. She didn't like to think about Miss Veens when she wasn't her, although sometimes the other girl appeared suddenly, the way you might think about an old friend. An evening lying about the apartment, and she might think, I wonder what Miss Veens would be doing right now. Then there she was, Miss Veens, lounging in her lush home, a fur rug peeking between her toes, not this cramped studio she shared with a sister who always smelled like starch. Or one night, when they'd stood outside a restaurant, waiting to be served at the colored window, she thought Miss Veens would not receive her food out an alley window like a street dog. She couldn't tell if she was offended or if Miss Veens was on her behalf. Sometimes she wondered if Miss Veens was a separate person altogether. Maybe she wasn't a mask that Stella put on. Maybe Miss Veens was already a part of her, as if she had been split in half. She could become whichever woman she decided, whichever side of her face she tilted to the light. No one in the estates knew what to make of it. Stella Sanders crossing the street to visit with that colored woman. Marge Hawthorne swore she saw her venture over months ago, Stella ducking her head as she carried a cake in her arms.
Welcoming that woman here, can you believe it?
Marge asked, and nobody did believe her, not at first. Marge was always imagining things. She'd sworn twice that she had seen Warren Beatty at the car wash, but then Kath Johansson spotted Stella and Loretta at the park, sitting side by side on a bench. Their shoulders rounded, casual and easy. Loretta said something that made Stella laugh, and Stella actually reached for Loretta's cigarette and took a drag. Put that colored woman's cigarette in her own mouth. This detail, specific and odd, made the story stick, not to mention the fact that Kath was telling it. She'd always been a little enamored with Stella, orbiting around her like a satellite planet. Happy to be washed in her light. But when she told the other ladies about Stella and Loretta, Kath said that she'd never known Stella well, not really. And besides, there was always something a little strange about that woman. Betsy Roberts interrupted to tell the group that just that Monday, she'd seen Stella walking across the street with her daughter.
That's the shame of it, she said, to bring that little girl into all of this.
But what all of this meant was anybody's guess. No one said a word to Blake Sanders, who'd noticed Stella's strangeness, but had already accepted that his wife was the type of woman who fell into moods he could not decipher. His mother had warned him about her, said she wouldn't be worth the trouble. He'd just started dating Stella then, but she'd been his secretary for 2 years already. He spoke to her more than to anyone else in his life. He could sense by the shape of her shoulders if she was in a bad mood. He could read in the slant of her handwriting when she was hurried. But dating Stella felt like unfolding an entirely new mystery. He never met anyone else in her life. No family, no friends, no former lovers. Back then, her distantness seemed dreamy, romantic even. But his mother said that Stella was hiding something.
I don't know what, she'd said, but I tell you this, her family's still alive.
Then why would she say they aren't?
Because, his mother said, she probably comes from some backwoods Louisiana trash, and she doesn't want you to find out about it. Well, you'll find out soon enough.
His mother had wanted him to marry a different girl, one who came from a certain pedigree. In college, he'd escorted that type of girl to dozens of formals, society girls who bored him to tears. Maybe that's why he was drawn to the pretty secretary who came from nowhere and had nobody. he didn't mind her secrets. He would learn them in good time. But years had passed, and she was as inscrutable as ever. He came home early from work one afternoon, calling her name, and found the house empty. When his wife and daughter finally returned, an hour later, Stella, surprised to see him, bent to give him a kiss.
"Sorry, darling," she said. "We were at Kath's, and I lost track of time."
Another time, he'd beaten her home because she'd stayed too late at Betsy Roberts' house.
"What were you two talking about?" he asked later.
She was sitting in front of her vanity mirror, brushing her hair. 100 strokes each night before bed. She'd read it in Glamour once. The red brush blurred, mesmerizing him.
"Oh, you know," she said. "The girls, little things like that."
"I've just never known you to be like this."
"Like what?"
"Well, friendly."
She laughed.
"I'm just being neighborly. Aren't you the one who's always telling me to get out more?"
"But you're gone all the time now."
"What am I supposed to do?" she said.
"Tell Kennedy she can't have friends?"
He'd been a shy child, so he never had many friends, colored or otherwise. But he did play with Jimbo, an ugly black rag doll with a plastic head and queer red lips. His father hated his son running around with a doll, a nigger doll at that. But Blake carried him everywhere, whispering all of his secrets into those plastic ears. This was a friend, someone who guarded your feelings behind that frozen red smile. Then one day, he stepped into the yard and saw clumps of cotton scattered all over the grass. On the dirt pathway, there was Jimbo, gutted, arms and legs strewn, his insides spilling out.
"The dog must have got to it," his father told him.
But Blake always imagined him tossing that doll into the dog's snapping jaws. He'd knelt, picking up one of Jimbo's arms. He'd always wondered what the inside of the doll might look like. For some reason, he thought the cotton would be brown. By Christmas time, Stella had spent so many afternoons at Loretta's house that out of habit, she told Loretta one Monday that she'd see her tomorrow.
"It's Christmas Eve, honey," Loretta said laughing,
and Stella laughed too, embarrassed that she'd forgotten. She always dreaded the holidays. She could never stop thinking about her family, even though their celebrations were nothing like hers now. A tree so tall the star brushed against the ceiling, so much food for dinner that she got sick of leftovers, and mountains of presents awaiting Kennedy. Each December, she piled into the department store with the other mothers, clutching the letter to Santa, and tried to imagine a childhood like this. The twins always received one present apiece, something useful, like a new church dress. One year, Stella received a piglet from the Delafosse farm that she named Rosalie. For months, she'd fed Rosalie, running when the pig chased her around the yard. Then Easter Sunday came, and her mother killed the pig for supper.
"And I ate every single bite," she told her daughter once.
She thought the story might teach Kennedy to be a little more grateful. She hadn't expected the girl to burst out crying, staring at her as if she were some monster. Maybe she was. She didn't remember crying for that pig at all.
"You all doing anything exciting for the holidays?"
Loretta asked.
"Just a few people coming over," Stella said. "A small thing. We do it every year."
The party was not a small event. They'd hired caterers and a string quartet, invited the entire neighborhood. But of course, she couldn't tell this to Loretta. She'd known, licking the invitations shut, that she could never invite the Walkers. On Christmas Eve, the Johansons arrived first, bearing a brick-hard fruitcake, then the Pearsons carrying bourbon for the eggnog. The Robertses, deeply Catholic, brought a tiny blonde angel for the tree. Then the Hawthorns waving from the front steps with homemade fudge, the Whites with an ironic beach snow globe,
and soon the living room crowded with company. Stella felt hot from all the people, or the mulled wine, or maybe even from knowing that across the street, Loretta could probably hear the music. She must have seen that endless parade of neighbors climbing up the steps. Or maybe not. Her own parents had arrived that evening. Stella had watched the elderly couple climb out of the Cadillac, Reg hefting the suitcases from the trunk, Loretta wrapping her arms around their backs as they glanced around the neighborhood, as dazed as if they'd stumbled into another country. Wouldn't her own mother look at her new life the same way? At least Loretta's parents would be proud. She had come upon her nice things the honest way, not by stealing a life not meant for her. Then again, she and Loretta had both wound up in the estates by marrying well. Maybe there wasn't such a big difference between the two after all. Blake swapped her empty glass with another mulled wine, bending to kiss her cheek. He loved hosting parties, even though it only made Stella want to find a corner and hide. Betsy pulling her into a conversation about linens, Kath asking where she'd purchased an end table, Dale dangling mistletoe over her head. She was lingering on the edge of a circle, wondering if her daughter was still spying through the banister, always afraid that she was missing something exciting. Then the circle of neighbors lit up with laughter, smiling at her, awaiting a response.
"I'm sorry," she said. "What was it again?"
She was so easily embarrassed at these parties. She'd catch herself on the edge of a political discussion, the Vietnam situation, perhaps, or an upcoming election, and someone would ask what she thought. Even though she read the newspapers and had her opinions like anyone else, her mind went blank. She was always afraid that she'd say the wrong thing. Now Dale Johansson was smirking at her.
"I said, I'm wondering when your new friend might show up," he said.
"Oh, I don't know," she said. "I think everyone's here by now."
When the others exchanged amused glances, she blushed. She hated being the butt of a joke.
"What are you talking about, Dale?" she said.
Dale laughed.
"I'm just asking if your friend from across the street is coming. I'm sure she can hear the music out there."
Stella paused, her heart thrumming.
"She's not my friend," she said.
"Well, people are saying that you've been calling on her," Kath said.
"So?
So, is it true? Have you been visiting with her?"
"I don't think that's any of your goddamn business," Stella said.
Betsy Roberts gasped. Tom Pearson laughed uncomfortably, as if he were willing it to become a joke. Suddenly, Stella felt as if she had transformed into a totally new creature in their eyes, something wild and feral. Kath stepped back, her cheeks pink.
"Well, everyone's talking," she said. "I just thought you should know."
The nerve of that woman. In front of the bathroom mirror, Stella fumed, splashing water on her face. Where did Kath Johansson get off anyway? Storming into her house with that dry slab of fruitcake and telling her to her face in her own home, in front of everyone, that the entire neighborhood was judging her. Dale grinning dumbly beside her, Blake watching with that confused look on his face, like he'd woken up from a nap to find all these strangers standing around in his living room. She'd stormed upstairs and smoked a cigarette hanging out the bedroom window. She could hear the quiet murmuring of the party downstairs, Blake, no doubt, making excuses for her. "Oh, don't mind Stella. She's always a little testy this time of the year. Yes, her holiday blues. Who knows? Who can understand that woman half the time anyway?" Then the Johansons and the Hawthorns and the Pearsons, stepping carefully down the walkway, past the manicured lawns, behind their identical front doors, to whisper about her. If only they knew. The thought ran through her head deliciously, the same way she always thought, driving on an overpass, of turning her wheel and sending herself careening over the rail. There was nothing more tantalizing than the possibility of total destruction.
I mean, can you believe it? She told Blake. In my own home, talking to me like that. I mean, where does she find the nerve?
She furiously spread night cream on her face. Blake lingered behind her, unbuttoning his shirt.
Why didn't you tell me?
He said. He didn't look angry, only worried.
There's nothing to tell, she said. The girls like playing together.
Then why wouldn't you tell me? Why would you lie about going to Kath's?
I don't know, she said. I just thought it seemed easier that way, all right? I knew you would have all your questions.
Can you blame me? He said. You've never been like this. You didn't even want them to move in.
Well, the girls like playing. What was I supposed to do?
Not lie to me, he said. Not tell me you're doing one thing, then sneaking over there all the time.
It's not all the time.
Kath said it was twice this week.
Stella laughed.
You can't be serious, she said. You can't truly be taking Kath Johansson's side over mine.
It's not about sides, he said. I've been noticing it too, you know. You're not yourself. You've been walking around like you've got your head in the clouds. And now you're chasing after that Loretta woman? It's not normal. It's...
He eased up behind her, cupping her shoulders.
I understand, Stella. I do. You're lonely. That's right, isn't it? You never wanted to move to Los Angeles in the first place. Now you're lonely as all hell. And Kennedy's getting older. So you probably... Well, you should take a class or something. Something you've always wanted to do. Like learn Italian or make pottery. We'll find you something good to do, Stell. Don't worry.
One night, long ago in New Orleans, Blake had invited her to a work banquet.
I'd hate to go alone, he told her. You know how these things are.
And she'd nodded, even though, of course, she didn't. She told Desiree she had to work late and instead borrowed a dress from one of the other secretaries. Blake met her in the lobby of the banquet hall, as dashing as any leading man.
Aren't you a sight for sore eyes?
He whispered into her hair. All evening, he never left her side, his hand always lingering at the small of her back. At the end of the night, he brought her to a cafe for coffee, and halfway through her cherry pie, he told her that he was moving back to Boston. His father was sick, and he wanted to be closer to home. Oh, she said, dropping her fork. She hadn't realized how desperately she wanted more nights with him like tonight, until she realized that there would never be another. But he surprised her, touching her hand.
I know it's crazy, he said, but I've got a job offer in Boston, and...
He faltered a second, then laughed.
It's crazy, Stella, but would you join me? I'll need a secretary there, and I just thought...
They hadn't even kissed yet, but his question sounded as serious as a marriage proposal.
Just say yes, he said.
And the word tasted like cherries, sweet and tart and easy. Yes, and just like that. She could become Miss Veen's for good. She didn't give herself a chance to second guess. She didn't plan how she would leave her sister, how she would settle in a new city on her own. For the first time in her life, she didn't worry about any of the practical details when she told Blake Sanders yes. The hardest part about becoming someone else was deciding to. The rest was only logistics. Now she glanced at him through the mirror, Blake watching her with those soft, worried eyes. She'd created a new life with a man who could never know her. But how could she walk away from it now? It was the only life she had left. On Christmas morning, she leaned against Blake's chest, watching their daughter squeal and dive into her pile of gifts. A talking Barbie that spoke when you pulled her cord, a Susie Homemaker oven set, a red spider bicycle. Look at this, look at that. She must have been such a good girl this year. Unlike all those rotten poor children staring at empty trees who must have deserved it, bad because they were poor, poor because they were bad. She'd never wanted to participate in the Santa myth-making, but Blake said that it was important to preserve Kennedy's innocence.
It's just a little story, he said. It's not like she'll hate us when she figures it out.
He couldn't even bring himself to say the word lie, which was a lie in itself. Scraps of wrapping paper littered the carpet, Kennedy collapsing in a blissful haze. Stella opened each of Blake's boxes to reveal another gift she hadn't asked for. A floor-length mink coat, a diamond tennis bracelet, an emerald necklace he fastened as they stood together in front of the bedroom mirror.
It's too much,
she whispered, fingering the gem.
Nothing is too much for you, my sweet, he said.
She was one of the lucky ones, a husband who adored her, a happy daughter, a beautiful home. How could she complain about any of it? Who was she to want more when she'd already taken so much? She would have to stop playing these foolish games with Loretta Walker. Stop pretending the two had anything in common, that they existed in the same universe. That they could ever be friends. She would have to tell Loretta that she couldn't visit her anymore. In the kitchen, she mashed potatoes until her arms burned. She slid pineapple wedges into the folds of the ham and pushed it into the oven. Blake, watching the Lakers wallop the Suns, told her that Kennedy had gone outside to play with the other neighborhood kids. But when she stepped out, she didn't see the Pearson boys racing bicycles past, or the Johansson girls tugging their wagons, or anyone tossing a football. No children at all. Their cul-de-sac empty, except for Kennedy and Cindy on the Walker's lawn, both girls crying. Loretta kneeling between them, frazzled, still in her apron. Stella ran across the street, grabbed her daughter, searched her skin for cuts and scrapes, but she didn't find any, so she pulled Kennedy in for a hug instead.
What's the matter? She asked Loretta. Did something happen?
A fight over a new toy, maybe. Talking Barbie was lying in the dirt between them, but Loretta stood, grabbing her daughter's hand.
You should know, she said.
Her voice was strangely cold. Maybe she had heard the music from the party last night. Maybe she was still sore about not being invited. Stella stroked her daughter's hair.
You have to share, honey, she said. What did Mommy tell you about that? I'm sorry, Loretta. She's an only child, you know.
Oh, she shared plenty, Loretta said. Keep her away from my girl.
What?
Now Stella stood, gripping Kennedy's shoulder protectively.
What are you talking about?
You know what she said to Cindy? Well, the girls were playing some game, and Kennedy was losing, so she said, I don't want to play with the nigger.
Her stomach sank.
Loretta, I...
No, I understand, Loretta said. I don't blame her. It all comes from the home, see? And like a fool, I let you into mine. The loneliest goddamn woman in this whole neighborhood. I should have known. You stay away from me.
Loretta quivered, powerless in her anger, and all the angrier for it. Stella felt numb. She guided her daughter back across the street. As soon as she shut the door, she grabbed Kennedy and slapped her. The girl yelped.
What'd I do?
She asked, crying again. Behind her, the crowd on the television roared, Blake cheering along. Stella stared into her daughter's face, seeing everyone that she had ever hated. Then she was looking at her daughter again, gazing at her with watery eyes, a hand covering her reddened cheek. Stella fell to her knees, pulling her daughter close, kissing her damp face.
I don't know, she said.
I don't know. Mom is sorry.
Years later, Stella would only remember speaking to Reg Walker 3 times. One morning when she stepped out to collect the newspaper as he was leaving for the set, and he paused on the driveway and said, "Lovely day, ain't it?" She agreed that it was, watched him climb into his sleek black car. The second time, when he came home to find her sitting on the couch with his wife and paused a little in the doorway, as if he'd walked into the wrong house.
"Hi there,"
he'd said, suddenly shy, and Loretta laughed, reaching for her glass of wine.
"Sit with us a while, baby," Loretta said.
He didn't, but before he left, he leaned over to light her cigarette, their eyes meeting in a glance that felt so intimate, Stella looked away. And the third time, when Reg helped Stella unload her groceries. She should have recoiled as he came near, but she let him carry her bags inside, the walk from the driveway to the kitchen counter feeling unnaturally long. Even Loretta hadn't been inside her home before. She walked with him down the lonely, sterile hallways, where he set the bags on the counter.
"There you go,"
he said. He didn't even look at her. But a week after Christmas, sitting around her sewing circle, she told Kath Johansson and Betsy Roberts that he made her uncomfortable.
"I don't know," she said, plucking at her misplaced stitch. "I just never liked the way he looked at me."
3 days later, someone threw a brick through the Walkers' living room window, shattering that tiled vase Loretta had bought in Morocco. Tom Pearson and Dale Johansson both claimed credit, although it was neither of them. Instead, Stella later discovered, it was beat-faced Percy White, who'd taken the new neighbors as a personal slight, as if they had only moved in to mar his presidential term. Some applauded him, although it made others uneasy.
"This is Brentwood, not Mississippi," Blake said. Tossing bricks through windows seemed like something the gap-toothed trash did.
But a week later, a different man, desperate to prove himself one, left a flaming sack of dog shit on the Walkers' front steps. Days later, another brick sailed through the living room window. According to the newspaper, the daughter was watching television at the time. The doctor had to remove glass shards from her leg. By March, the Walkers left the estates as suddenly as they'd arrived. The wife was miserable, Betsy Roberts told Stella, so they'd bought a new house in Baldwin Hills.
"I don't know why they didn't just do that from the start," Betsy said. "They'll be so much happier there."
By then, Stella hadn't spoken to Loretta since Christmas Day. But she still watched through the blinds as the yellow moving van pulled up and a pack of young colored men slowly carried cardboard boxes out of the house. She imagined marching across the street to explain herself, standing in Loretta's cavernous living room, Loretta balanced on one moving box while taping another shut. Loretta wouldn't look angry to see her. She wouldn't look like anything at all, and her blank face would hurt even more. Stella would tell her that she'd only said those terrible things about Reg because she was desperate to hide.
"I'm not one of them," she would say. "I'm like you."
"You're colored," Loretta would say. Not a question, but a statement of blunt fact.
Stella would tell her because the woman was leaving. In hours, she'd vanish from this part of the city, and Stella's life forever. She'd tell her, because in spite of everything, Loretta was her only friend in the world. Because she knew that if it came down to her word versus Loretta's, she would always be believed. And knowing this, she felt, for the first time, truly white. She imagined Loretta pushing off the box and stepping toward her, her face frozen in awe, as if she'd seen something beautiful and familiar.
"You don't have to explain anything to me," she would say. "It's your life."
"But it's not," Stella would say. "None of it belongs to me."
"Well, you chose it," Loretta would tell her. "So that makes it yours."
Part 4. The Stage Door. 1982. Chapter 10. If you went to the park's Korean barbecue on Normandy and 8th during the fall of 1982, you'd probably find Jude Winston wiping down one of the high tables, staring out the foggy window. Sometimes, before her shift started, she sat in a back booth reading. The noise never distracted her. The other waiters didn't understand it. She told Mr. Park on her first day that she'd practically grown up in a restaurant, a diner, really, even though she'd never waitressed before. She did not tell him that most of that time had been spent reading, not watching her mother run the place, but maybe as a father himself, he was sympathetic to restaurant kids. Maybe he respected her eagerness to find a job. Barely a week after her college graduation, and she wasn't lazing about on the beach like his own sons would have done. Or maybe he just remembered her from the past spring, always sitting at a high top, studying a worn MCAT book she'd borrowed from a teammate. When he'd brought her pork belly and asked how she was doing, she always got a dazed look in her eyes, as if he'd asked in Korean. She was a smart girl, he could tell. Plenty dull boys wanted to go to medical school, but only smart girls found the nerve to apply. He'd finished 2 years of medical school himself, back in Seoul, so he understood her anxiety and wished her luck. He was always wishing her luck now, even though she told him she wouldn't hear back from any schools for months. Ah, well, good luck then.
You don't need luck, Ree said. You're gonna get in.
He stole a shrimp off her plate with his chopsticks. He visited sometimes during her dinner break, but Mr. Park never minded. He was a fair boss. She was lucky to work for someone like him, and still she could only think about the letters that would arrive in the spring. Rejections, mostly, but maybe one yes. You only needed one yes to be happy. Medical school was like love in that regard. Some days her chances seemed promising, and other days she hated herself for clinging to this ridiculous dream. Hadn't she muddled her way through chemistry, struggled in biology? You needed more than a good GPA to get into medical school. You had to compete against students who'd grown up in rich families, attended private schools, hired personal tutors. People who had been dreaming since kindergarten of becoming doctors, who had family photos of themselves in tiny white coats holding plastic stethoscopes to teddy bear bellies. Not people who grew up in nowhere towns, where there was one doctor you saw only when you were puking sick. Not people who'd stumbled into the whole idea of medical school after dissecting a sheep's heart in an anatomy class. 7 schools were reading her application right now and would, in a few months, decide her future. Made her sick to even think about.
I figured out how to fix that ceiling, Rhea said. I know it's been driving you crazy.
It was November and already unreasonably wet. Every morning this week, they'd driven through deep pockets of rainwater on Normandy, worried the car would stall. At home, they nudged a silver bucket underneath the leaking ceiling, which Reese dumped on the sorry patch of grass behind the garden's apartments. The Edenic name of their building always made him laugh. Why not call this building the brick slab, or the no hot water, or the hole in the roof? But Jude didn't find that funny. She glanced back at the clock. Only 5 minutes left of her break.
Why don't you just call Mr. Song? She said.
No, he's too old to be climbing up that ladder.
He should hire someone then.
Too cheap,
he said, squeezing her hip. He'd found a new job at the Kodak store, selling cameras and developing photographs. He missed the camaraderie of the gym.